This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. If you can believe it, we're now 36 days from the election, so the ads are pretty much unavoidable. The candidates are unavoidable. And from here on out, it's all fundraisers, debates, handshaking, and baby holding. And for political junkies, there's a lot this week. Tonight, Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown meet for the second time at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And of course, Wednesday, on the biggest stage of them all, Mitt Romney and President Obama square off for the first of their three high wire battles. And joining me to talk through all the angles and to get at some of the substance, too, behind all the flash, are Jim Kloppenburg, Professor of American History at Harvard University. He is also author of the book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition, and Dan Kreider, Associate Professor of Politics at Brandeis University. Jim and Dan, thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So let's start with some of the polling that's out today, which, you know, for all the talk about Romney really being in a terrible slump, we've got a new political poll showing Obama up 49-47, a new poll from ABC, Washington Post, showing exactly the same thing, 49-47. Jim Kloppenburg, is this race closer than people tend to acknowledge?
Well, I think the data on the swing states has been giving people the false impression that it's over, because the expectation, I think, was that Governor Romney would be stronger in many of the swing states. And I think in the last few weeks, his standing in all of the swing states has slipped. And as a result of that, I think people are coming to the premature conclusion that it's now President Obama's race to lose. It is still within the margin of error in a lot of the polls. And so I think it would be a little early to call it for him. But I think at this stage, people were expecting Governor Romney to have a bit of an edge because of the problems that the American people are dealing with the economy. And given that, this latest surge by the president is something of a surprise.
So you think there's still an opening for Romney here to bring it home, to be victorious maybe in the debates, and to win?
It's a small opening, but I think it is still an opening. The debates, as people have been reading in recent days, have historically made less difference than our obsessive focus on it might suggest that they make. And that's not to say they're unimportant, but it's rare that they serve to swing the results from where they were before the first debate happened. And so if that pattern holds, the president would coast to a narrow victory.
Dan Kreider, do you think we could see anything in the debates that could really shake things up? Are you expecting that Mitt Romney may really throw President Obama a curveball?
I don't. I think that Obama's a very, very disciplined and thoughtful politician, and he's obviously tampering our expectations, as is his staff. But in fact, he's a very steady fellow and very well prepared, someone who has a really good facility with public policy, and I think actually a very effective communicator. We know that, in fact, we shouldn't pay too much attention to any single poll or even one or two polls at a time, but that political scientists like to aggregate polls. And that's one of the things that we see online now, is several sites that are aggregating polls and following trends in polls over time. That tends to produce better evidence, better data going forward. And as Jim suggested, we need to break it down by states. And I think when you aggregate the polls, when you look at trends, and if you go state by state, Obama's actually in a rather good position right now.
Yeah, you know, Nate Silver, who is very closely followed in terms of looking at polling from the New York Times, he's going to be on our air soon, and he was on Meet the Press this weekend, and he said, in his view, there's an 80% chance of Obama winning. So I'm going to have you, I'm going to start with Dan Kreider and have you both look back into history. But what Nate Silver says is, if you look at, for example, the Gallup poll, you go back to 1936, 18 out of the 20 people that were ahead at this time, which Obama is right now, ended up winning the election. The two exceptions were Al Gore, who did win the popular vote, but just for a lot of reasons that we won't go into, didn't win the Electoral College, and Thomas Dewey, who ended up being beaten by Truman, but up until the last minute, people didn't think that would happen. You know, 80%, boy, those are pretty good odds for the president. So when you look back at history, is that how you read it too?
I follow Nate as well, and I think he's one of the more reliable pundits or political analysts that we can find in the public sphere these days. And, of course, forecasting models are a large cottage industry in political science, and there are numerous variations. But one striking thing about the research into political identity and political behavior over the long term is that the American electorate is driven by fundamentals, such as the state of the American economy. Battle deaths in wars also have a big effect on vote share. And, in fact, percent change in gross domestic product from January to September, the first three quarters of the year, is probably the single most important factor in determining the vote share of an incumbent party. And, of course, our economy is extremely sluggish, to say the least, but the numbers have reflected a very modest but very stable low-level improvement in GDP over the last year or so. So I do think that this is Obama's race to lose. I think we knew that some months ago. Political scientists knew that, despite the fact that I think in many journalistic circles, he was looking like a very wounded candidate. In fact, these kinds of fundamentals are enduring, and they are very good predictors in terms of outcomes of elections. I think it's his race to lose.
Jim Koppenberg from Harvard, what's your perspective on history? If you look at those two outliers since 1936, only Al Gore, who then went on to win the popular vote, and Truman, who did defeat, you know, Dewey in this very, very tight battle. Does it look to you like, again, Obama may really be looking at potentially shoo-in here?
He does look very strong at this point. And I think one of the differences between political scientists and historians is that historians pay a lot of attention to contingencies. And so there is still the possibility in the next month that something we absolutely cannot predict will happen. And if that happens, it could play in either of two ways. It could be a great advantage to Obama if there's an international crisis and he is perceived to have done very well. But if it is a disaster, even if it's through no fault of his own, that could hurt him. So I think it is true that at this point he is a very strong favorite. There's another way to gauge that in addition to the polls, and that is something called Instatrade that asks people actually to put their money where their guesses are. And that, too, is coming in at just about exactly 80%
wow.
for the president, which is quite striking. And even though that hasn't been around nearly as long as polling has been, it has rarely been wrong. And I think it does indicate that people who are putting their money where their mouths are have a clear sense that the president is riding high. One of the issues that I think has become clear in the last few weeks, in addition to the debates about the 47% and the change that worked in people's perceptions of Governor Romney, a recent book by a man named Michael Grunwald called The New New Deal has put in front of the eyes of a lot of people who follow politics evidence of the effect that the American Recovery Act had. And much of
what we call the stimulus.
Right,
sort
the
of
stimulus package
culture,
actually
yeah.
did a lot to change the situation for people at the very bottom of the economic pyramid. And as pundits, I think, are becoming more aware of what had been invisible, there's been an inclination to give the president a little bit more credit for having accomplished in the economic sphere, as he did with the health care reform and with the reform of the financial regulation of the financial industry, credit for having accomplished more than people had thought. When people had said as a sort of refrain, why didn't he attack the economy? He did attack the economy. And an $800 billion stimulus, Grunwald points out, is 50% larger in real terms than the outlay in the New Deal. And very few Americans, I think, were aware of that because there's been such a steady drumbeat about how inadequate it was. And it could have been worse is not the best slogan you could ask for, but it is an indication, I think, of how much it did accomplish.
It's interesting. I cited the ABC Washington Post poll that came out today showing that 49-47 Obama to Mitt Romney. But if you look inside the numbers, it's really interesting. Okay, you look at the economy, they're tied. How much do you trust the candidate to handle these issues? Obama and Romney are tied at 47%. How much do you trust them to handle health care? The president is ahead, 48 to 44%. Taxes, the president is ahead, 49 to 44%. Women's issues, if you get into social issues, the president is ahead 54 to 36%. And terrorism, which, Dan Kreider, you think of very often as a real Republican issue, and Mitt Romney looks like he's going to do a big foreign policy speech soon. The president is ahead in terms of how much people trust him to handle terrorism, 53 to 39%.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? That's not even close. How did this switch occur? Because, you know, we've often heard of sort of the mommy party and the daddy party, and the Republicans, they may not be great on the social issues and polling, but they will keep you safe.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. And I think, you know, finding explanations for these trends in polls is a difficult business. But I would just note that Obama's tenure has been marked by no significant acts of terror. He also was presiding over the elimination of Osama bin Laden on May 1st, 2011. And I think he received quite some substantial amount of credit for that fact. It's been a relatively quiet phase in the war on terror. And that's something that I think voters tend to recognize. With reference to women voters, I do think that this has been a pretty consequential few months with the comments by Representative Aiken about so-called legitimate rape. I think the conventions were also consequential in that the Democratic convention seems to have produced a more enduring so-called bounce in the polls. I think a lot of convention watchers saw Bill Clinton and remembered why they were Democrats, because that was probably the most stunning moment among both of the conventions. And I think that Romney's comment about the 47% has also seemed to have had some degrading effect on his standing in the polls as well. So I do think that there are these contingent events involving human agency that have affected some of these longer-term trends.
Jim Kloppenberg, let me turn that upside down a little bit, because we also saw this weekend the 2,000th death in Afghanistan being marked. You know, we've been in that war for about 11 years, and I think people are somewhat uncomfortable with our foreign policy right now. Why isn't there more blowback against the president for that?
Well, I think Dan hit the nail on the head when he focused on the conventions. I think it became apparent to people when they listened both to the Republican convention and the Democratic convention just how out of touch this Republican Party has become from the American people. If you look at other polls besides the popularity polls, if you look at the Gallup polls on issues over the last few months, they offer a resounding rebuke to the Republican Party platform. People are not in favor of cuts to Social Security or Medicare. They are not in favor of continuing tax breaks to millionaires. They're not in favor of increasing the budget of the Defense Department. To the contrary, they'd like to see the budget of the Defense Department cut. People do not have an appetite for another war in Iran. And the louder that the saber rattling of the Romney-Ryan ticket becomes, the more turned off I think people are by the idea that having just completed one war and seeing another one wind down, that we should be gearing up for a third war. I think the American people understand that the reason for the deficit is that for the first time in U.S. history, we went into two wars without raising taxes. Not only did we not raise taxes, we cut taxes while we were at war. That's the reason for the deficit being as serious as it is, even given the escalating cost of Medicare. So I think if you look at the way the American public feels about particular issues, they're solid between two-thirds and three-quarter majorities with the Democratic Party on most of these issues. And I think the conventions made that clear to people in a way that much of the coverage of the campaign has missed. On the issues themselves, on the substantive issues, large majorities of Americans simply do not agree with Romney and Ryan. And I think that's part of what we're seeing in these recent polls about people's likely choices in the election.
I think the other, if I could jump in, the other surprising thing about the Americans' perception of Obama is that he's very highly regarded. Despite the noise that the Republican Party tends to generate regarding their outright dislike for the man, he, by historical standards, is very well liked by the American public, who actually sees him as warm and empathetic, something that also sounds slightly counterintuitive. But it's similar to the standing that Republicans held Ronald Reagan to in the first term of his presidency. Obama is an extraordinarily popular president, especially among Democrats. And I think that's a filter through which a lot of Americans view contemporary events, even foreign policy issues. They trust the man and they believe he's a thoughtful person.
We're talking about the politics of the week with Dan Kreider, Associate Professor of Politics at Brandeis, and Jim Kloppenburg, Professor of American History at Harvard University. And Dan Kreider, let me go back to you. You're talking about the idea of being sort of warm and connecting to people. Both Mitt Romney and President Obama have put out in recent days ads where they really try to talk to you, the voter, specifically. Let me start with the Romney ad, where this is an ad from the campaign last week, and he's really trying to strike a compassionate tone.
Too many Americans are struggling to find work in today's economy. Too many of those who are working are living paycheck to paycheck, trying to make falling incomes meet rising prices for food and gas. More Americans are living in poverty than when President Obama took office, and 15 million more are on food stamps. President Obama and I both care about poor and middle-class families. The difference is my policies will make things better for them.
Dan Kreider, Romney then goes on to say that you should measure compassion by how many people are off welfare, not how many people are on welfare. What do you make of this ad?
Well, my sense is that this ad was a very specific adjustment to the problems caused by the leak of Romney's videotape in which he talked about the dependent 47%. And unfortunately, a candidate who is continually playing defense, like Romney seems to be, is at a real disadvantage. And I think the second salient fact is that in the polls, it does seem that most Americans do date the economic crisis to the Bush administration, and they're more likely to associate blame with the prior administration than they are with the Obama administration. They have some sense that this was an extraordinary economic crisis and that its roots actually are found in the prior presidential election.
Jim Kloppenburg, does that ad feel to you like defense?
It feels like desperation to me. It's a faint echo of George W. Bush's compassionate conservatism, which was abandoned as soon as he was elected. Again, I think if Americans look carefully at what the Romney-Ryan ticket is offering, there is none of the care about poor and middle-class families that Governor Romney talks about in that ad. To the contrary, there is nothing but free market dogma. And the record from the Reagan administration, from the second Bush administration, is very clear. If you indulge in that kind of free market orthodoxy, the consequences for people at the bottom are disastrous. And it has been during the Clinton presidency and during the Obama presidency that there has been more economic growth than there was during those Republican presidencies, except for people at the very top. And listening to Elizabeth Warren at the convention, listening to Bill Clinton, listening to Barack Obama, I think people got a reminder of the one-note quality of the Romney campaign. It is all about deregulation, and it is all about tax cuts. And as Dan said, the American people remember that those strategies of deregulation and tax cuts brought them the crisis of the 2008 recession.
I want to get into that in just a minute. But first, let's hear President Obama's new ad, where he does much the same thing, sort of talks right to you, the voter. They're trying to, I think, break out of the chaos of negative third-party ads. So here is an ad from the Obama campaign, and he is making the case for four more years.
During the last weeks of this campaign, there will be debates, speeches, and more ads. But if I could sit down with you in your living room or around the kitchen table, here's what I'd say. When I took office, we were losing nearly 800,000 jobs a month and were mired in a rut. Today, I believe that as a nation, we are moving forward again. But we have much more to do to get folks back to work and make the middle class secure again.
Dan Kreider, after that, Obama goes on to say that Romney supports tax cuts for the wealthy, loosening Wall Street regulations. In fact, very much of what Jim Kloppenberg just said, sort of these familiar themes of the campaign. How does that one-on-one in your living, if I could sit down with you, add feel to you?
I think Obama's team picks music very well. It's a wonderful...
Special talent.
Yeah, there's a wonderful tone to it. The kind of heartstrings are plucked. But I think that, look, there are a couple ways to think about how voters view the past and the present in presidential campaigns. One is through a retrospective evaluation of the last 4 years. And on this frame, Obama actually may not do as well as he would under another frame, which is simply laying out the choice between the two ideologies, regardless of the last 4 years. And I think that's what Obama continually tries to do, and that is to present this as a very stark, and I think it's accurate, choice between two rather very, very different and rather polarized political parties, and that that is a frame for this final campaign season that I think serves him very well. But as I say, his popularity has degraded very slowly. All presidents lose popularity over time. Obama's has degraded very slowly. Only JFK at this point in his presidency has been more popular than Obama among Democrats.
Wow.
And the fact is, this is his first term. Voters tend to give first-term presidents a bit more leeway. And the economy has been very stable. Poor, slowly improving, very stable. All those factors, those are three very important factors which are providing a kind of foundation for Obama's reelection chances.
Jim Kloppenberg, I want to go back to you on something you said and question you a little bit on it. You said that there's really, you know, trickle-down economics don't work that well, that the middle class don't tend to benefit. We learned that under President Reagan. But, you know, we don't know what's going to happen ultimately in 2012. But if we go back to 2008, the election between President Obama and John McCain, and you look at how the vote broke down. It's true. Obama got 80% of minority votes, you know, ran away with that vote. He got 47% of white college graduates. John McCain got 51%, so they were pretty close there. But when you look at white working class voters, people who are suffering, people who are very much in the middle class, if not the lower middle or in peril of dropping out of the middle class, Obama got 40% of those voters. McCain got 58%. And it wasn't that close an election. I mean, Obama clearly won, and yet he was nowhere with those voters. So somehow they have been, they believe that Reaganomics works for them.
I'm not sure they believe that Reaganomics works for them. I think that the entire approach of the Republican Party since 1980 has been to peel working class voters away from the Democratic Party using cultural issues rather than economic issues as the wedge. And they've been remarkably successful at that. I think part of what has happened again is that they have overplayed that hand. And the Aiken candidacy is only the most extreme example. But again, when you hear Paul Ryan talk about the culture wars, or when you hear him talk about the economy, it is clear that he stands way outside the mainstream of American politics. And so I think there is a clear evidence this time that the taking of the Republican Party by the radical right is finally eroding their ability to capitalize on the culture wars. I think one argument you could make about the two ads that you played is that at this stage in the campaign, both parties have to do something to reach out to that tiny sliver of the electorate who really doesn't know anything about politics. And so the soothing music that Obama is playing, the soothing voice that Romney adopts in his spot are attempts to say, even if you don't know anything about politics, you like me, right? Mm-hmm. And there is something almost pathetic to those of us who follow politics closely in that least common denominator quality. But I think there's something of that going on both sides. Let me say one more word about the substantive issue that Dan identified that I think we really do need to focus on. The Romney-Ryan team has made a point since the Republican nominated convention of making redistribution the central issue in the campaign. And what they do not want to acknowledge is that we have seen the most significant redistribution of wealth in the United States in the last 30 years than we've seen in all of American history. And it's a redistribution to the top.
Do you think people are aware of that?
Well, I think, again, that's part of what Bill Clinton's job was at the convention, mm-hmm. to make sure that people were looking that in the face. And the president was, as presidents are supposed to be, a little bit more restrained in his presentation. But I think it is the case that the Democrats need to remind those white working class voters that this has not been working for them. It hasn't been working for them ever since 1980. And they need to stop focusing on symbolic issues that have very little to do with their lives and start focusing on the eroding power of the minimum wage, on the way in which billions of dollars are being siphoned out of the economy, billions of dollars that could have gone to other purposes to line the pockets of billionaires. And so I think that economic focus, which came through very clearly in the Democratic nominating convention, has been the principal focus since then for Obama and his campaign team.
Dan Kreider, you know, let's talk for a minute about voter turnout. I'm going to play you a clip from Ralph Reed, who is the chair of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, who has long been somebody who has really worked to get out the vote amongst that white working class, many of whom are Christian and evangelical. He was talking on Meet the Press yesterday about the chances of a Romney comeback, but he also, the fact that Ralph Reed has come back and is putting so much money and effort into this race, I wonder if that indicates to you that there may be a really not-to-be-messed-with voter turnout operation here. Let's listen to what Ralph Reed had to say yesterday.
I wouldn't hang too much on a single poll. I mean, remember, on this day in 2000, Al Gore was ahead of George W. Bush by 2 points. Bush was leading him by about 3 points going into the last weekend. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. At this point in 1980, Carter was leading Reagan by 4. There was a Gallup with 5 days left that had him up by 6.
So, Dan Kreider, Ralph Reed thinks a turnaround is possible here. He cites history, but I think he also knows that he's got a lot of people on the ground. There's a big turnout operation going on, not just by the Romney campaign, but by a lot of affiliated Republican-leading, conservative-leading groups. What do you make of the idea of just coming out for turnout?
Right. I do think that this is still an indication that the Republican right is desperately trying to activate its base. And one puzzling fact that I think corresponds to this is Governor Christie's great enthusiasm for the upcoming debate is kind of oversell.
Let me stop you there because we've got a clip of that.
Okay.
You will hear him on Meet the Press talking this up. Let's listen to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie yesterday.
You saw the change in those polls happen very quickly. And I'm here to tell you this morning, it can happen very quickly back the other way. And I think the beginning of that is Wednesday night when Governor Romney, for the first time, gets on the same stage with the President of the United States, and people can make a direct comparison about them and their visions for the future. And Wednesday night's the restart of this campaign, and I think you're going to see those numbers start to move right back in the other direction.
Dan Kreider, there it is, talking it up, the Wednesday performance.
Wishful thinking. And all I can imagine is that he and Ralph Reed have decided that what they really want to do is have as many undecided voters or uncommitted voters watch the debates in the hopes, I think desperate hope, that something will happen during the debate that will actually swing the electorate in one direction. I think it's very, very unlikely to happen. And the fact is that there are a number of really strong fundamental trends, attitudinal and demographic, that favor the Democrats. This president is very popular despite the fact that he's African-American. That costs him something like 3%, 4% in the polls. Even just based on his race, he's overperforming.
I just have a question. How do you know that costs him 3 or 4%? I mean, can you really do a poll where you say, but if he was an African-American, how would you really vote?
Right. Well, political scientists make their modest incomes by trying to figure out these kinds of puzzles. They project vote share, controlling for certain economic, social, demographic, racial, ethnic variables. And there have been several articles published on this, and I think there is a consensus that there's a cost in the electorate to Obama's race, that it has declined since the last election, but it cost him something like 3 to 4% last time, which would have turned that election into really something more like a landslide. We're also seeing really the rise of the registration of Hispanic voters. Something quite remarkable is the really quite rapid sort of ascendancy of the notion that gay marriage is legitimate. This is a remarkable aspect of the Democratic National Convention. It was not just a fact that was presented by various speakers, but it was celebrated. And there was no pushback. There was no controversy surrounding it. That particular policy problem, I think, is going to be swept forward through age cohorts replacing elderly Americans. That's something that will favor the Democrats in the future as well. So I think that these, to me, are indications that the Republicans are hoping beyond hope that there can be some kind of game-changing event. I think it's very unlikely.
I'm Kara Miller. We're talking politics with Dan Kreider, professor of politics at Brandeis, and Jim Koppenberg, professor of American history at Harvard. And Jim Koppenberg, to what Dan Kreider said, you do have a demographic problem, I think, in some respects for the Republicans. I mentioned to you before, Obama got 80% of minority votes in 2008 and 47% of white college grads in 2008 and 40%, just 40% of white working class voters. The problem for the Republicans is minority votes has increased since then, the number of minority groups. The number of white college grads stayed the same. The number of white working class voters decreased. And that's the pattern, right? So you see this bifurcation in favor of the Democrats. Just if everybody stays where they are and they just watch the numbers unfold the way they're going to, the Democrats are going to have a lock on the presidency for a long time. So I assume the Republicans are going to change their argument at some point.
Well, I think that has been the reason for the focus on cultural issues, because that's been the only leverage they have on the economic issues. What do they have to offer that white working class voter? Very little. So when you hear that refrain, "We want our country back," there is a kind of nostalgia there masquerading as policy, but it really is simply an expression of dissatisfaction with the way in which the culture is being transformed, and it's not going back to the way it was before, despite the power of that nostalgia for certain Americans. And I think when people observe, as is so often done, those demographic facts, people neglect the reasons why minorities of all sorts were voting so heavily for Barack Obama. It was not simply that he was an African American. Those same minorities were voting for Bill Clinton, who's a good old boy from Arkansas. So the reason, I think, is that minorities understand that on the economic issues, the Republicans have very little to offer people at the bottom of the economy in America. And the Democratic Party is trying its best through its social policies to address the problems of poverty and the problems of inadequate income, which at a certain level are what lie behind the sluggish response to the recession. There's not enough buying power to get demand going. And many people, even in the business sector, understand that. And that was the reason why the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers were in favor of the stimulus, even though the Republican Party opposed it, because they understood unless you put dollars in people's pockets, they can't buy what our economy produces.
They also feel differently about immigration. Will there be, if Mitt Romney were to lose this election, which, as we said before, by no means is assured, there's still a real closeness there in the polls. But if he does, and we see demographics, just the numbers continuing to go the way they do, where there's just fewer white working class voters as a percentage of the electorate and more minorities, and that's just how it's going to be. And we already kind of know from demographics, that's pretty much baked into the cake for decades ahead of us. Is there going to be a revolution within the Republican Party to figure out, okay, how do we win nationally?
That's a very good question, and we don't know the answer to that because, in fact, it's so much is hanging in the balance there that some observers thought when Paul Ryan was named the vice presidential pick that it was an attempt by Republican moderates to say, okay, we're going to give you Paul Ryan and we're still going to lose. So you folks simply have to wake up that unless we go back to the center, we're looking at several decades of electoral defeats. Mm-hmm. I think the Republican Party has decided they're simply going to double down on the cultural issues with the hope that Hispanic Catholics will vote with them on abortion rather than on any economic issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the brilliant strokes of bringing one of the nuns on the bus to the platform in the Democratic National Convention. There is a tradition of progressive Catholicism in America. During the New Deal, there was a priest named John Ryan, who was known as Right Reverend New Deal, who was a constant supporter of the programs that Franklin Roosevelt proposed against the opposition of many American conservatives. And even though that progressive Catholic voice has been muted, it does speak to many Hispanics. And I think the Republicans are assuming that they can make inroads into that rising minority because on many issues, Hispanics tend to be more conservative. But I think they're missing the boat if they think that that is the only issue on which Hispanics vote. And we'll see at the end of this election, if it does play out the way Dan and I both think it will, whether there is an attempt to shift the focus of the Republican Party or whether they have decided this is our ideology and we're going to stick with it regardless of the consequences.
Right, this is our base. Dan Kreider, we're talking about cultural issues. Let's switch to a state cultural issue. We've seen in recent days two fascinating ads by Senator Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren. And they both engage, and Elizabeth Warren has been reluctant to do this, they both engage on the issue of her Native American heritage, which has been, of course, contested back and forth. So I'm going to play both of them. Let's first listen to Scott Brown's ad, in which he used his newscast to sort of make the case against Elizabeth Warren's heritage claims.
Elizabeth Warren is trying to put questions about her heritage behind her.
Warren admitted to identifying herself as Native American to employers.
Something now genealogists have said they have zero evidence of.
She's facing tough questions about whether she claimed to be a minority for professional gain.
Warren did give an answer. The problem is it keeps changing.
Is there anything else that's going to come out about you that we don't already know?
You know, I don't think so, but who knows?
And I have to say, I was walking around my house, heard this on TV, this next ad, and I stopped because Elizabeth Warren has generally stayed about as far from this issue as she possibly can. But here's a new ad in which she engages on the issue and tries to answer some of these questions about her heritage. Let's listen to it.
As a kid, I never asked my mom for documentation when she talked about our Native American heritage. What kid would? But I knew my father's family didn't like that she was part Cherokee and part Delaware, so my parents had to elope. Let me be clear. I never asked for, never got any benefit because of my heritage. The people who hired me have all said they didn't even know about it. I'm Elizabeth Warren. I approve this message. Scott Brown can continue attacking my family, but I'm going to keep fighting for yours.
Dan Kreider from Brandeis, what do you make of these two ads? Here we are late in the campaign, October, and they're talking about, Elizabeth Warren's ancestry.
Well, I think it's, on the one hand, Brown's attack seems trivial, but I do think that it's a clever way to frame a very Republican concern, which is that American society is sorting itself into the so-called makers and the so-called takers, and that too many people takes advantage of a bloated federal bureaucracy to gain some kind of advantage because of some status that they claim regarding ethnicity or minority racial characteristics. So it invokes this problem that Republicans have with a culture of dependency, which I think is a big thing of in the national tickets campaign appeals as well. On the other hand, I think it may be that most American families can actually really sympathize with Warren because I don't know any numbers on this, but I think a lot of families have a folk wisdom that actually Native Americans are part of their family tree. It's a very common claim in the American melting pot. We all, as families, choose from a number of different choices as to how we ethnically identify, what kind of stories we tell our children about where our family roots are from, because we have 24, 48 choices. I think it's a very common story that one hears as a child. And I think that it's probably a good move for her to make that clear, that these are stories that she's inherited and that she's never tried to gain advantage through them. So I think, I expect that this debate will be fought to a draw, this particular question, and probably will turn out to not have a great deal of effect on the outcome.
Jim Kloppenburg, does this attack from Senator Brown have teeth? Does it feed in, as Dan Kreider says, to the maker versus taker argument? And I'll say, you know, that the Christian Science Monitor focused on this issue in the last couple of days of Elizabeth Warren's heritage. And they say the Association of American Law Schools included her in its 1986 to 1987 directory on a list of minority law teachers. In a 1996 Harvard Crimson piece, a law school spokesperson called her one Native American on the faculty. And the records haven't been released, so it's a little hard to negotiate what people knew and what she claimed and that kind of thing. Does this attack have teeth?
I think it shouldn't. It's conceivable that it does because, in fact, even being Native American would not affect Harvard's interest in hiring her, and that's well known. So this is an attempt to shift the conversation away from issues, and it's part of a broader, I'd say, content-free campaign that Scott Brown is trying to run. One of my favorite ads of the campaign has him in his famous pickup truck, which we now know he bought so that he could haul his daughter's horse around, going to visit an aging veteran who had won the Congressional Medal of Honor. And he thanks the man for his service, and the man says, "No, Senator Brown, thank you." And I couldn't help thinking as I watched that, what am I supposed to think now? Because he is kind to aging veterans, I should vote for him as my senator. I'm not quite sure if I were to be kind to an aging veteran, should I be a United States senator? I don't see what that has to do with the issue of policy. And I think the question about Elizabeth Warren's heritage is, as Dan said, a much slipperier question than the Brown campaign would like to admit. I have a great-grandfather who is reputed by family lore to have come to America as a stowaway on a ship from Europe. We don't actually know whether that's true, but every member of my family believes it. Now, if someone were to go back into the archives and discover that that is not true, would it be accurate to accuse every member of the Kloppenburg family of having lied for decades? I don't think so. And I think it's a similar sort of thing. If indeed Elizabeth Warren's parents eloped because of opposition from her father's family to her mother's Indian heritage, that is the reality. That is the experienced reality for her. I don't know why, once the genealogical evidence was out, she didn't simply say, "I now understand this was lore that is not factually accurate."
But do you think, but I feel like Senator Brown's argument is she gained unfair advantage by being somebody
that. And there's no evidence of that. That's
somebody that Harvard could say, "Look, we do have a diverse faculty, and here's an example of somebody."
No, I think she's quite accurate when she says she's never used it for personal gain. And Harvard doesn't make appointments based on people's identity. So I think it is preposterous on the face of it, whether it actually works or not. Is another question, because campaigning 101 tells you that the best thing you want to say about your candidate is three cheers for Joe Smith. And when you're talking about the other candidate, you say, "Let's end the parking meter scandal." And while your opponent is trying desperately to answer their "what parking meter scandal? What are you talking about?" you're home free. And I think that's exactly what this non-issue is designed to do. And the fact that it does seem to make a difference to as large a percentage of people as it does, I think is an indication of the success of that strategy. But it shouldn't deflect our attention from the very different policies that Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren stand for.
And a final question for you, Dan Kreider, in just our last few seconds here. We see polls out today on this race, the Brown-Warren race, one from Massing WBUR showing 46-44, she's ahead. One from the Boston Globe showing 43-38, she's ahead. Now, both of them have large contingents of undecideds, but I wonder, are these two people being buffeted by national wins? When you ask people, who are you going to vote for in Massachusetts, the Boston Globe poll did this, the 30% of people say they'll vote for Mitt Romney, 57% say they'll vote for Obama.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is a case where the debates might matter in a electorate that's so evenly divided. I do think that Warren's fortunes began to rise more sharply around the time of the conventions. And that does seem to me to suggest that she is She is being lifted by the rising tide led by the National Democratic ticket. But it's very, very close. And it does seem like this is a campaign in an election that could boil down to real time and to the perceptions that voters have about these two candidates in the last few weeks.
And we'll be watching the debate tonight at UMass Lowell to see if there's fireworks, anything exciting happens. I've been joined by Dan Kreider, Associate Professor of Politics at Brandeis, and Jim Kloppenburg, Professor of American History at Harvard, and the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Thank you so much to both of you. Great discussion.
My pleasure.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3. Hey, Callie.
Kara, we're going to continue our election coverage with 30 issues in 30 days. Mitchell Hartman from Marketplace is joining us to discuss our next issue, job retraining. This is something you've talked about a lot on Innovation Hub.
It is, and it's really important as older line jobs are replaced by completely new jobs that necessitate new skills.
I'm Callie Crossley.
And I'm Kara Miller. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.